And welcome to the Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5 FM. And I'm Phil Taylor. You can, I always say this at the top, you can write to us, Taylor at CIUT.FM. Check us out, Taylor-Report.com. And with me is Phil Conlon. How are you doing, Phil?
Good afternoon, Phil.
Today we're going to talk to Eve Engler. He spoke at a conference on the weekend, scienceforpeace.ca. It's a terrific program. Sarah Flounders was there, and we had her on the program last week. Judy Deutsch and her organization did put together quite an interesting panel, including Mr. Yakov Rapkin, a great scholar at the University of Montreal. And we thought we would get back in touch with Eve to talk about two things. One, he has a new book, but also to reprise some of his remarks at the meeting, because the backdrop of the meeting was the potential war against the Islamic Republic. But sometimes it's spoken of rather sadistically as the bombing, as though they wouldn't defend themselves. They would just have to take it. If people remember the bombings carried out against Iraq, they actually didn't defend themselves. In the case of Libya, they had a no-fly zone. They don't think to remind us that Libya observed it. They did not fly, but they were attacked anyway. So I think their model is you corner someone that you think you have superior force to, you then attack him, and his only hope of survival, according to the way you've arranged it, choreographed the violence, is that he won't resist. Libyan ships were sunk, soldiers killed. But just starting with that first point, they did not fly. They said, okay, we accept. That wasn't good enough. They got bombed anyway. And so when they talk about, you know, what they might do now with Syria or the Islamic Republic, it's assumed that this is going to be what, rich hunters call hunting. That is where they sit in a tree and they are given a high-powered rifle with a scope. And then some poor devil goes out in the woods and puts the game in range, and then they kill it. That's called hunting. That's their idea about war, which is why they all speak like sort of people belong in an insane asylum. Because we can just step in as though they're in a movie, and they'll always get away with it. Anyway, that's the appalling reality. And by the way, I thought thematically we might say a couple of things here while we're waiting to speak to Eve, and that is that Hollywood just had its show. And Jesse Jackson at Counterpunch pointed out that the people who vote for the Oscars are overwhelmingly elderly white males. So I guess we shouldn't be surprised that they gave an award to a black actress who played a maid, is my understanding. And this would be the second time now that Hollywood has given an Oscar to a black woman playing a maid, the first being Hattie Daniels. And I don't think we're getting very far. If this is 2012, this is Black History Month. And so I saw a historian commenting about it. And she said, you know, this is a story which the main thing is to message is that these black maids love the white children that they care for. That's what we should take away from it, is that no matter what, they've had bad times, et cetera, but their key thing is love, and it's projected towards the superior group. And that's a pretty horrible thing to say. This person also pointed out, she's a student of this issue in American history, that in the 1920s, several Southern senators, United States senators, tried to establish a monument called the Mammy Monument, which would honor black women who had been servants. In other words, it was like real affection from their former masters or their present employers. So they would have a black mammy monument. That's kind of horrible. The other thing she pointed out is that Rosa Parks had been a black domestic worker for a white family, And she, Rosa Parks, reported in her autobiography that she had been sexually assaulted by her employers, something about which no one, of course, would do anything. You can't do anything about that because you lose your job and everything else happens. So that's the reality, that again, the backdrop of this horrible situation. And I was recalled and had called to my memory that I once attended a lecture by James Baldwin. And I was told to go by a white professor, woman of the Southern persuasion, I'm going to say, who, you know, honored the old South. And she told me to go, and I did attend. And she came away in a state of shock because Baldwin said in the lecture that William Faulkner was a damn fool, and that William Faulkner was telling us a fairy tale that we wanted to believe. And the fairy tale was that there's a crisis in his novel, and the white family is worried about their child, and the maid has a son who's being hunted by Klan types, and she is more concerned about the white child than she is about her own son. And James Baldwin said, "If you believe that, you are insane, and the culture is insane." And I remember my professor saying, "I never thought of it that way." So that's why, you know, Hollywood let us down. But we're joined by a guy who never lets us down. That's Eve Engler. How are you doing?
How's it going, Phil?
Hey, thanks for taking the time. I know you have your new book and you are touring. And by the way, where are you speaking today?
At Queens in Kingston.
I'm having a little trouble with my sound. I
don't know, in Kingston.
Whereabouts is it?
At Queens University in Kingston.
Oh, Queens University in Kingston. And you're going to be in Hamilton. I want to make sure people know about all this. You're going to be in Hamilton. When is that?
Hamilton on the 6th of March, and Toronto on the 9th of March. And I don't know if there's main listers in Waterloo on the 8th, Windsor on the 7th, and Peterborough on the 5th.
Peterborough on the 15th?
On the 5th of March.
Well, we had you on talking about it. It is a great book, and it seemed very apropos of this conference you attended on Saturday and were one of the featured speakers. And I was really glad that you were there. I was glad to have the kind of the perspective you bring about Canada's role in these matters, such as the present ganging up on Syria, if I could put it that way, Friends of Syria, and the talk of an attack on Iran. Your take on this, I should just ask you, but my impression is that tends to be a kind of naive view in our culture about how what role Canada tends to play in these U.S.-led, NATO-led affairs. Could you talk about that?
Yeah, I mean, if you start with the presumption that foreign affairs is concerned about human rights and civilian populations around the world, then it might seem reasonable to, you know, what they're currently doing vis-a-vis Syria, vis-a-vis Iran. You might think that, you know, the intent is to improve the situation for those who are those who are being victimized. But if you take a look at the history of Canadian foreign policy, I think that you would come to a fairly different conclusion. And I think that in terms of the talk on Iran, what we see going on today right now with Iran is the Harper government is really beating the war drums for an increased attack against Iran. There already is a war, a low-level war taking place, the Israeli-U.S. Bombing of scientists, funding of opposition groups, funding of both armed and not armed opposition groups, all kinds of sort of menacing military operations, obviously a huge number of military bases. And you see the Harper government contributing that with Canadian naval vessels patrolling off the coast of Iran and running provocative maneuvers. You see that with Harper equating the Iranian leadership to Hitler and or John Barrett actually about 2 weeks ago when he was in Israel, and this is the level of hypocrisy is too much, because the claim is this is well, we're doing this because Iran is producing or possibly going to build nuclear weapons, yet we try to block International Atomic Energy Agency resolutions calling for a known nuclear power in the Middle East, Israel. We try to block attempts to, you know, have a nuclear-free Middle East because our ally in Israel is has the bomb, not, you know, might possibly sometime down the line. And I think that what's important, you know, in terms of the Pearson stuff is to see Canada's position going back to the nationalization of oil in Iran and how the Canadian government was really hostile. Pearson was really hostile that, supported the British-American role in overthrowing the Mossadegh government. And I think that, that should inform, to a certain extent, our understanding of what's going on in Iran today, or Canada's position vis-a-vis Iran today.
Mm-hmm. This is Eve Egler, and the book is the new book, Lester Pearson's Peacekeeping, The Truth May Hurt. It actually does. It raises something else. How did we get on this track of total acceptance of NATO as the shaper of Canadian policies? I mean, I noticed, for example, the NDP hasn't got a word to say about this. I haven't heard him say a word about Syria.
Yeah, no, I mean, well, unfortunately, I said this elsewhere, but that, you know, the NDP's foreign policy today is... it's horrible. You know, the full-on support for the bombing of Libya, refusal to say no to intervention in Syria. I mean, the list goes on in all kinds of different areas. But the reality is, if you go back in Canadian foreign policy history, the NDP supported the creation of NATO. The NDP supported the Korean War of 1950 to 1953, the NDP criticized, actually the CCF, should I say, predecessor to NDP, criticized the nationalization of oil in Iran. Unbelievably, I was actually totally astounded to see that. They joined Lester Pearson.
I'm astounded right now.
Yeah, criticizing the nationalization of oil. So it was okay for, you know, them to call for nationalization of industry within Canada, but you know, if some third world place did that, out of bounds.
Yeah. Now, Eve, they did. It is peculiar. I think they did once say they don't quite listen to their members, right? They had I think at some convention they voted to withdraw from NATO or consider withdrawing or something.
I believe so. I believe they have. I think a couple decades ago they have talked. They have a resolution on ostensible resolution calling for the withdrawal of NATO. That is something that's just. Sitting in paper and is not
causes the leaders to blush.
Exactly, and I think you saw some of that with a lot of their position on Afghanistan, for instance. I think the vast majority of NDP members were very critical of what was going on in Afghanistan, but for the most part, the leadership, passed the resolution or went along with passing the resolution, and then didn't do much about really campaigning on the issue. And it's the only instances, I think, really, where you can see really sort of getting to pretty principled positions by the NDP or fairly good positions on foreign policy is when there is just an absolute overwhelming support from the grassroots, when there's a lot of mobilization taking place at the grassroots. And I think in a context of lead-up to the war in Iraq, that's an example where you see some more forthright positions being taken by the NDP. And so I think, how that informs us is not necessarily concern ourselves too much about what the NDP is saying or not saying, but building that, the presence in the street, the popular consciousness, and that's what leads to, okay positions coming from them. And you see that even with apartheid South Africa or Vietnam, where the NDP was quite soft early on in their criticism, certainly in terms of Vietnam. Uh-huh. And then with the growing mobilization, that position got firmer.
Mm-hmm. Again, this is Eve Engler, and he's the author of a new book, Lester Pearson's Peacekeeping, The Truth May Hurt. And he's touring Ontario pretty much right now. And an issue that came up Saturday at this scienceforpeace.ca, I'm going to call it, so people can go to the site and learn more. But the issue of human rights has somehow kind of worked like a corrosive in the anti-war movement. Everybody says, okay, let's not have a war, but we must make, we're going to make sure we say something about human rights. At least that's my impression. Why has this become such a big factor when we're trying to prevent a NATO's assaults on smaller countries?
Yeah, I mean, the criticism briefly at the conference was that there were people from the Iranian community that didn't feel like that felt like it was essential for those criticizing Canadian, U.S., NATO policy in Iran to also condemn the regime in Iran. Sort of as an atheist, as someone who believes in economic democracy, I have, you know, little sympathy for the regime in Iran. But I think that the politics, internal politics of the regime in Iran, are so far down the list of importance in terms of our responsibility as people living in Canada, our capacity to affect change, and the overwhelming danger for the people in Iran, and for that matter, the world in general, is the power of the military power of the U.S., Canadian, NATO machine, and that's what we have to do our best to weaken and to focus on the questions about the internal. To what extent have there been positive transformation in Iran over the past three decades, and to what extent is Ahmadinejad sort of pro-capitalist or sufficiently pro-working class, whatever? To me, those are very, very much secondary questions.
By the way, they must be secondary questions for the Pentagon, since they're targeting Syria, which is their problem is that they're being attacked by so-called Islamists, which I hear very few people mention. I'd like to ask, Eve, to get your opinion. What about the hypocrisy we have to deal with here? There have been people arrested here in Canada. There have been people hauled off to Guantanamo because of alleged links to al-Qaeda. Now al-Qaeda says they support the armed struggle in Syria. And I haven't heard the Prime Minister or the President of the United States say that they don't want anything to do with al-Qaeda in Syria.
No. I mean, hypocrisy. One of the same funny things about the hypocrisy is that we don't hear about it in our media, but when Canada criticizes Iran's human rights record, the Iranian regime repeatedly criticizes Canada's human rights record. So they talk about the arrests at the G20 a year and a half ago. They talk about the plight of First Nations in response.
You mean they're interfering in our internal affairs?
Exactly. They interfere in our internal affairs.
Criminal.
But in the case of Syria, we see happening in Syria was this. I don't know if you may have seen the articles about Libya that just came out from David Pugliese, the defense writer at the Ottawa Citizen, and he said that the people in the Canadian military during the bombing of Libya were joking that they were the air force of Al Qaeda, because so many of the opposition fighting in Libya, the anti-Gaddafi forces, were jihadist kind of people. So I presume quietly, when not in a public way, but Canadian officials and whatever, making the similar type jokes today with regards to Syria. And the situation from what I can tell in Syria is it's bad in all directions. I mean, the government in place there is brutal. The opposition is highly sectarian. There's all kinds of really terrible violence that is playing out now, and that whatever direction we go, things are looking bad. But what is clear to me, at least, is that you add to that mix a bunch of NATO fighter jets bombing, and what you're talking about, making a bad situation that much worse. And we have a lot of examples in history to suggest that that's what would happen if foreign intervention took place.
Yeah, we saw with Libya. This is Eve Engler, and Eve, I know you're going to have to give a talk soon, so I'm not going to make you put you in a tight press. But you're the author of Lester Pearson's Peacekeeping: Truth May Hurt, and you're t- tell us again, just if you could quickly, where you're going to be speaking in the near future.
Well, March 6th, 6 p.m. at McMaster in Hamilton. March 9th at OISE at 7 p.m. In downtown Toronto, and then at 1:30 in the afternoon at York, and then also on the around the Toronto area for that whole week. And there will be details of the not currently up, but there will be details of all the stuff on my website at evingler.com.
Great. It's a terrific book, and I hope they sell a ton of them, and we look forward to seeing you. Thank you very much.
Thanks a lot, Phil.
Okay, bye-bye. It's Eve Engler. Again, the title of the book is Lester Pearson's Peacekeeping, The Truth May Hurt. Let's hope. We're going to be, in about 10, 15 minutes, we're going to be talking to an old friend of ours and a leading guy in the trade unions here. Son of a legendary trade union leader. We're going to talk to Jacob Leibovich, and we're going to end about the there was a demonstration today of taxi drivers, and we're going to have him fill us in what that was about. I want to make sure there's some other announcements. Beth Satoun has some events, Phil.
Yes, Beth Satoun is 2 years old, and they're going to have a party to celebrate that fact on March the 10th. This is a fundraiser. So please come and bring your wallet. There is an admission.
Send the wallet.
Yeah, there's an addition. It's a suggested minimum of $20. I love the democracy of that. I mean, they say nobody's going to be turned away if you're broke. But if you're not broke, bring $20 or a little more to cover the ones who are. Yeah. It's on Saturday, March the 10th, 6:30 p.m. until 10 p.m. Celebrate two great years and a third to come. Second anniversary and open house at Beth Satoun. Flavors begin at 6:30 p.m., by which they mean refreshments, savories, and desserts. And the music starts at 8, and they have some very interesting music, musicians from Syria, Egypt, not the kind of stuff we hear on the CBC or anybody else, right? I mean, among other things, we don't get Arabic music anywhere in the mainstream in this town. So this would be quite.
It's
a
very
thing.
Addictive, by the way. Yes. I the sound of it. I like when I travel the Middle East. Yeah. I like the sound.
Also at Beth Satoun, this Wednesday night, the 29th of February at 7 p.m., Chronicles of a Disappearance by Elia Suleiman, Palestinian Cinema at Beth Satoun. This is a documentary. Elias Suleiman is a Palestinian director from Nazareth, and this is his kind of collage of Palestinian life. And that's this Wednesday night, 7:30 p.m., Beth Satoun, which is, of course, is at, where is that address? 612 Markham Street, right?
612 Markham.
612 Markham Street.
A terrific location.
It's a great location.
It's great for the community, right. Great for everybody. So, by the way, just read the dates again, if you could quickly.
Sure. Wednesday the 29th at 7:30, Chronicles of a Disappearance by Elia Suleiman, and the big party to celebrate their second birthday on Saturday, March the 10th at 6:30 p.m. At Beth Satoun.
6:30 p.m., March 10th.
March 10th.
Beth Satoun.
Yes.
612 Markham. Okay.
There you go.
And the Canada-Cuba Friendship Organization is sponsoring a talk by a Professor Davila at 25 Cecil Street, and that's February 29th. That's Wednesday at 7:30. And the title is, I think, Scientific Progress in Cuba. That's Dr. Davila is speaking, 25 Cecil, and that's Wednesday, February 29th at 7:30. That's the Canada-Cuba Friendship. And I'm really glad to see these events at that hall. I attended a few of them. And on one occasion, I saw the wives and children of the Cuban Five. And I remember that standing up in the back of the hall to congratulate everybody on the meeting was Jack Layton, which to me was a great Layton moment, great for everybody. And by the way, the retired president of SEIU was there,
right.
And the national president of the Canadian Steelworkers.
That's right.
And you say to yourself, okay, that definitely couldn't happen in the U.S. That's how we define we're not, you are, et cetera. And another announcement, the Friendship House at 280 Queen Street West is going to have an International Women's Day gathering at 1:30 on March the 4th. There's celebration of International Women's Day, 280 Queen Street West, asking for $10 donation. And we wish them all the success. No War on Iran, Rally and March, Sunday. March. It must be spring. People are marching. That's a good sign.
Toronto spring. There you go.
Yeah. Which can sometimes be a little false. Yeah. Yes. But this is a brave population. No War on Iran, Rally and March, Sunday, March the 4th, 2 p.m., U.S. Consulate, 360 University Avenue. That's north of Queen. It's sponsored the Toronto Coalition to Stop the War. That's nowar.ca. And so go to that site, nowar.ca. And I mentioned before, Science for Peace. .ca for information on the work they're doing, and maybe I'm sure there'll be information or follow up on the event of this past weekend. Now, in the time before we speak to Jacob, we were talking about the Hollywood business, and I want to make sure I said something.
The business.
Yeah, and boy, I have a theory. See, we don't know who votes for these awards. And a lot of, over the years, many people have noticed political trends, and they seem to somebody who, in the behind the curtains, it tends to reinforce one kind of thought or another through the Oscar show, which makes me think maybe it's the same group that produces the Nobel Peace Prize, because that's equally mysterious. All the Nobel Prizes and Obama, who's now bombed countless countries. And is looking to bomb two more at least. He got a Nobel Peace Prize.
Well, he hadn't bombed anybody at that point. So they thought they better give it to him now before he gets into it.
Yeah, pre-bombing.
The pre-bombing Nobel Peace Prize.
Yes. Yeah. So it just, and again, why are we in thrall of these secret, rather plutocratic groups who we know for sure they're white males? They're definitely, Jesse Jackson breaks it down in Counterpunch, but I think he says they have an executive group that has one black female and no other blacks in the executive group. So they was what used to call that a twofer. Yeah. By the way, that's been the bane of Jesse Jackson's life in struggling for equality. He says they fight to get a job somewhere in a high profile job. And then the white power structure says, yes, we like this black woman. So as to kind of create havoc. That they had a big fight in the city of Chicago. We had all male broadcasters, and the black community said, we want a black broadcaster. So they said, well, we found a black woman we like, and so we'll hire her. And that became a big headache.
You know, by the way, there was a Canadian film, a Quebec film, that was in the running for Best Foreign Language Film, because somehow Hollywood considers French foreign in North America, which, of course, is itself insulting. But they had a political agenda, and there was an Iranian film that some people like to say is against the government in Iran, which maybe it is, maybe it isn't.
It's produced in Iran.
By an Iranian who lives in Iran or works in Iran. So if Iran is the dictatorial country that they say it is, then either this is a pro-government film or it's not the dictatorial
country. Well, I'll tell you how it is a pro-government film. I'll show you how it is. It is a brilliant piece of theater. It's a great story. It's a very obviously powerful story. It carries out the fact that Iranians are among the world's great filmmakers. Every year in all the competition, Iranians do very,
absolutely,
very
and,
well.
And for many years, that's been true.
And yeah. I hate to tell these people who want to, rather, I take pleasure in telling those who want to make war on this country, who like to portray it in where you have demons in every time there's something from CNN, CBS, it's all a demon exercise. If that were true, then how can they produce such beautiful theater and art? If you look at real demons in history, and I don't want to use the most famous, but they didn't produce any art. Brutal governments kill art. They kill it.
Well, they kill the artists. Yeah.
Well, I don't mean literally. Yeah. I just mean it happens. Yeah. It, you cannot create. At least, and certainly not, and produce it in the theaters run by an autocratic regime. But this is a country that has for a long time now produced terrific films. There's a style, by the way, and I've noticed Hollywood occasionally ripping them off. I see things now in Hollywood films that I already saw in Iranian films. Tricks in camera, tricks in story that I say, yeah, I saw that in an Iranian film. But I would say for the mad bombers in our midst, and they are only a mere 40% of the population, that you better answer the question, how can they be producing this great art and you want to blast them to pieces? Which one of you is the barbarian? It's you. And so, that, to me, is part of the deal. Yeah, they can die. The director may have his own opinions, and I don't know what they would be about the government. But he is in that country produced great art. And as you say, you can't really actually tell. I mean, what it seems to tell is a tragic and difficult story about a family being torn apart and the effect on children. And according to all the reviews I read, the director is so even-handed they couldn't make out what his point of view is, which is to say he's a great artist.
That's right.
That's like, you ever notice this with Shakespeare? Yeah. Everybody say, well, he obviously meant this, and you say, yeah, but I saw a guy who wrote a book 400 pages of proving he meant the opposite, which means that he's just as smart as you think he is. This is the Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5 FM. You can write to us, Taylor at CIUT.FM. We're going to take a break, and we'll come back and talk to Jacob Leavitt.
From the roots up, CIUT 89.5 FM. Toronto.
And we're back, and going to be talking to Jacob Leavitt. He's the executive director, iTaxi Workers Association. By the way, there's a website, itaxiworkers.ca, and I think he's on the line. Are you there, Jacob?
Hello, Phil.
How you doing?
I'm good.
Hey, you had some excitement today, huh?
Sure did.
Taxi, what happened?
Well, about 300 taxis showed up at City Hall and circled the block, honking their horns and raising their voices to urge the city to get on with the promised reform process that they announced about 10 months ago and have still yet to announce the first day of. So it was quite something to witness.
And it all came off as sort of expected, nothing untoward, and people are satisfied with made a point, as the saying goes?
Yeah, certainly we got a fair amount of attention. There was lots of media press conference we had inside because to coincide with the day of action, we also released a rather lengthy submission that backed up the 14 specific proposals that the association is putting forward as our roadmap for reform of the industry. And those proposals came out of a long process of consultations and surveys with the members, big open meetings for both our members and all drivers, and then a process of sort of honing those proposals and then voting on them democratically so that all the drivers could take part in that process that the association ran. It got a fair amount of media attention. We were also joined by a couple of prominent folks in this city. One is somebody who I think is familiar to your guests. Human rights lawyer Peter Rosenthal was on hand.
Good for him. He was there.
He was there. Yeah. He's doing well, and he spoke up about the inherent discrimination involved in the two tiers of licensing that the city has at the moment, and how it how that kind of discrimination has to end.
Mm-hmm.
We were also joined by transit expert and former city councilor Adam Jambroni. Who's been helping us develop our ideas about how to get the city to start considering taxis as part of the public transportation system, because certainly lots of people who don't own private cars will complete the final leg of their commute by taxi. And the availability of the taxis and the treatment of the taxis is important for both the taxi riding public and of course, the taxi workers themselves. So he was out to support us as well.
Now, you say he was present. He didn't. Peter Rosenthal represented you at the meeting, inside?
Well, we had a press conference where...
Oh, at the press conference, sorry.
Yeah, our president, Sajid Magal, a longtime taxi driver in this city and somebody who was part of the last reform in 1998 that was responsible for bringing in the ambassador license plate system, in particular the positive aspects of it, which is the owner-operator model, which we're really urging the city to hold on to as the best, you know, the best way forward. Presented the proposals, but then both Peter Rosenthal and Adam Jambroni spoke to their support for the recommendations and the need for them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I, by the way, I noticed in the press release it says the link between working conditions and customer service is strong. Making the industry better for drivers will make it better for passengers, which will benefit the city at large. I guess that's President Magal's statement. Now, the very first thing, of course, is this matter of the this task force. Now, what are you calling for there? What is it? The delay that's the problem?
Well, in our recommendations, there's a number of things that we call for. But the first and foremost, because the drivers themselves have told us it's their number one priority is driver health and safety. When we tell people that taxi drivers have the most dangerous profession of any profession in Canada, usually they're surprised. But the statistics show that as a taxi driver, you're in the profession where you're most likely to be murdered. In fact, it's twice the rate of police officers. The province itself, when they were bringing in the Bill 168 against violence and harassment in the workplace, list 9 risk factors for anybody working in the province that will, you know, show that their jobs are dangerous. Of those 9, taxi drivers qualify on 8 of the 9. They handle cash. They're alone. Yes. They interact with the public.
I think of it in a way that term way people like to use. Taxi drivers, in many cases, are first responders, aren't they?
Absolutely.
I mean, somebody hails them. And they're at their service, and of course, they risk their lives.
And that's part of the, you know, underlying the point about health and safety. As we framed it, is that on the one hand, we're asking for the city to get serious about having police officers and health practitioners and taxi drivers sit down and talk about what can be done to try and make the profession safer. There's not a lot of easy solutions. Some of your listeners may have been in taxis in New York City or other jurisdictions where they have these things, these shields that are to protect the drivers. But in Toronto, you have such a competitive market, and it's so open to luxury vehicles and limousines that a lot of the drivers are uncomfortable with putting the shields up because it would hurt business. And again, that links back to the idea that the incomes are so incredibly low, and the protections that taxi drivers have next to no protection in terms of Employment Standards Act or unemployment insurance. All of the margins are so razor thin that they, of course, work much longer hours than they really should. They take risks on the road in order to hustle for those fares to make enough money to pay their overhead, never mind, you know, try and feed their families and live a decent life. Mm-hmm. So underpinning all of our proposals are ways in which we want to urge the city to change bylaws to increase the income of taxi drivers. Mm-hmm. One of the recent studies showed that taxi drivers' average income works out to something like $4.78 per hour. We're looking at, you know, yearly incomes of around $20,000 for your average taxi driver. So we're talking people that are in real poverty, the working poor, and on top of that, they're considered independent contractors, so they don't qualify for WSIB or CPP or any of the other protections that a minimum wage worker in a Tim Hortons or a McDonald's might expect. Mm-hmm. So they really do fall through the cracks, and they've got the worst of both worlds.
Mm-hmm. I noticed, your point four matters that were raised emphasized the city should work with taxi dispatch companies, plate owners, and drivers to settle on a single negotiated rate per shift for the rental of taxicabs by drivers. This would prevent drivers from being taken advantage of while guaranteeing a fair amount of compensation for both plate owners and drivers. Talking about this matter, you're calling for only one type of owner's license plate for the taxi industry. Could you expatiate on that?
Yeah, no, I'm glad you linked the two. I'll start just with the plating system. In 98, the main concern of the city when they went through the reform was to try and improve customer service. And one of the things they noticed is that when you have absentee owners or passive investors, those who control the old kind of plate, which is called the standard plate, what there was a tendency for them to just attach their plate to a taxi cab and then rent it out to what we call shift drivers on a 24/7 basis. So there wasn't, there was not a lot of concern for the safety or the cleanliness of the car. There wasn't a lot of concern being paid to the drivers themselves, and so the industry suffered. What they got right in 1998 was to move away from a model where people could simply extract value from their plates without really contributing anything off the backs of the drivers, and they moved to what's called the ambassador plate, which is based on an owner-operator model. So all people who hold an ambassador plate at the moment are owner-operators. They're licensed taxi cab drivers that were shift drivers previously and are now, people who drive under their own plate. But there are restrictions on that ambassador plate that make it difficult for them to recoup all of the money that they need in order to pay for the overhead of purchasing the car, paying the dispatch fees, and all that. Mm-hmm. So, the first point is that they should take the best elements of the two plates, that is, owner-operator model in the case of ambassador, but also the ability for ambassadors to hire a shift driver as a second driver in order to recoup income off of that plate while it's while it's being held by taxi drivers, but to end the absentee ownership and to end the corporations only owning many plates and the passive investors who simply take profit out of the system. So that would have a direct impact on the owner operators who each got a single plate and were able to operate it, and then also they would employ one shift driver. But mm-hmm. but that doesn't go far enough towards helping the shift drivers who are simply employees, because they are still without protection and they don't have the same, they don't have the same vested value in a plate. So the second piece is to talk about how we get to a point where taxi drivers who are shift drivers can sit down with the owners of the plate and the other industry players and negotiate a maximum at the very least. Because what we're finding right now is that somebody who may have leased a plate from an owner for, say, $2,000 a month for the past 15 years, that owner can simply cancel that lease if they find a taxi driver desperate enough to pay $2,500 a month. And all that comes out of the driver's pocket themselves. And unfortunately, the municipalities in Ontario don't have the jurisdiction to set a cap. Interestingly, they do in some of the big cities in the United States, like Boston, where the municipal government will say, no brokerage or plate owner can charge a taxi driver more than, say, $400 a week to drive. In Toronto, they don't have the jurisdiction. So we're saying to the city, they got to take responsibility for trying to get everybody to the table so that we can at least stop the kind of cutthroat gouging that happens as drivers get more and more desperate to drive under a plate.
Well, as you know, we're led by a happy, help everybody city at the moment. you're calling for this task force. What kind of support do you have at the moment?
Well, we're attempting to build it, but we're finding an audience on city council, those progressives who, are now becoming more aware of the conditions under which taxi drivers have to live, and are seeing that the agenda of the current regime is not really paying much mind to the drivers themselves. They tend to be listening to, owners and brokers and agents and the rest of them. So as we speak with politicians and as we take it to the media and the understanding about taxi drivers' lives grow, we're finding more and more support.
Mm-hmm. Speaking to Jacob Leibovich, and he's the executive director, iTaxi Workers Association. There's a website, iTaxiWorkers.ca. And lastly, Jacob, what about labor, the labor movement? We have the Ontario Federation of Labor, people like that, the Metro Labor Council. What are they saying about this business?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, you know, as you can imagine, the let's just call them the established labor bodies have been pretty focused on some of the fights that they've been having with the municipal government around cuts to public services and public servants themselves. But we've been keeping in touch, and they're definitely supportive. Sid Ryan, the president of the OFL, was recently at a meeting that we had with a new group out in Markham, talking about the importance of organizing precarious workers. And certainly the United Steelworkers national offices been helping out a tremendous amount. Their research staff was responsible for quarterbacking the submission, and they gathered, you know, they did, you know, countless hours of research and study and really been helping quite a bit to keep the iTaxi Workers Association, on the right path with the proper support. So, we're enjoying more and more support. People start to see that taxi drivers are getting themselves organized and united to call for reform.
Yeah, and on top of that, you have the legal titan, Peter Rosenthal, and
that's right,
and Mr. Jambroni. It sounds like a really an important moment in the organization of taxi workers in the city. Jacob, we really appreciate it. Thanks very, very much.
Thanks for taking the time.
Sure thing. Okay, bye-bye. That's Jacob Leavage. I'm always going to make sure I say we all knew his father, who was a legend in organizing in trade unions in Ontario, actually across the country, now that I think of it. I have something here. We spoke with Eve Engler earlier. You and I, Phil, talked about this. The conflicting perceptions of what issues are about and how we end up with situations where you have a demonized government, whether it be the government of Syria today or that of the Islamic Republic, and to a certain extent, by the way, Russia-China, who that wonderful diplomat, Ms. Rice, at the United Nations, she called them despicable, which... See, you have to go to diplomatic training to learn how to be so dumb in public. But the part of our problem is, and thank goodness we have programs like this one, and of course you heard Democracy Now! And CIUT, is we need to hear from people like Eve Engler and others who study these issues and get at the facts. And we should know something. We should know about how news is generated out of the Middle East. And a place that has become a center of argument and disappointment is Al Jazeera. You know, when we first said, oh, isn't this wonderful? And now Al Jazeera sounds like the emir's family in Qatar. And that's because it belongs to the emir's family in Qatar. And the emir has gotten into a mood. He wants certain things. And we're not just imagining. There's a considerable evidence. And here's something from Al-Akbar English. And I recommend you go to this to their site. It's Al-Akbar. And I won't help you with the spelling. Google will do that for you. Al-Akbar .com, and click on the English. But the title is Syria's Electronic Warriors Hit Al Jazeera. And it says that it reveals there's dismay among Al Jazeera staff over its biased and unprofessional coverage of Syria. And these news of this has been leaked. So its staff at Al Jazeera say they're concerned, and they were exchanging, and some of them are rather big shots there. Damascus, this is the first paragraph. On Wednesday, the entire staff of the Al Jazeera network allegedly received an email instructing them to change their computers and email passwords. Earlier in the week, the network server had been hacked by the self-styled Syrian Electronic Army, and some of its secrets were released to the media. The major find to be made public was an email exchange between anchorwoman Rula Ibrahim and Beirut-based reporter Ali Hashim. The email seemed to indicate widespread disaffection within the channel, especially over its coverage of the crisis in Syria. Ibrahim wrote to her colleague saying that she had turned against the revolution in Syria after realizing that the protests would destroy the country and lead to a civil war. She went on to deride the opposition Free Syrian Army, which she described as a branch of al-Qaeda. This is the private thoughts of a news presenter at Al Jazeera. Ibrahim also complained about the attitudes of various colleagues at the channel's Doha headquarters, some saying of them, some of them have, quotes, refused to greet me ever since the outbreak of events in Syria because they hold a grudge against my sect. Al Jazeera staffers were relieved that the email exchanges had been leaked because it exposed the station's biased and unprofessional coverage of Syria. Hashim responded sympathetically. This is a guy in Beirut, saying he had opted to sit on the fence while sending the channel footage of armed men clashing with the army, which he had witnessed while reporting from northeastern Lebanon. He said that after he submitted the video, he was told to return to Beirut on the grounds that he was exhausted. So the boss says, "You're tired, come home." In her response, Ibrahim once again protested that she had been utterly humiliated. "They wiped the floor with me because I embarrassed Zuhair Salim, spokesperson for Syria's Muslim Brothers. As a result, I was prevented from doing any Syrian interviews and threatened with a transfer to the night shift on the pretext that I was making the channel imbalance." Nice things to find out. Ibrahim also spoke of how Syrian activists invited onto Al Jazeera used terms of sectarian incitement on air, which the Syrians understand very well. Hashim wondered, in response, where the channel's head of news, Ibrahim Hilal, stood on all this. Ibrahim answered that he was stuck between a rock and a hard place, the agenda and professionalism. This conversation was broadcast in full on the state Syrian news channel, which also interviewed the hackers who broke through Al Jazeera's information system. Anyway, there's where a lot of our trouble comes. And by the way, that also tells you why Hillary Clinton is so enthusiastic about Al Jazeera. It's because these professionals are being told what they can and cannot say. And indeed, one of them says that she was suffering intimidation in the building because of her sect, which is to say, I'm afraid that would mean she's probably Alawi. And we have, as someone pointed out, broadcasts coming from Syria. Also inside Syria, but also from Saudi Arabia, in which they are threatening genocidal war on Alawis. And yet Hillary Clinton keeps a straight face and all of her NATO colleagues, while actual incitement to racial and this would be religious violence, which has got to be the ugliest form of violence, certainly in the history of the Protestants and Christians, it didn't leave any very many standing when you begin that kind of thing. So that is, you can get in Al-Akbar, and I really recommend you turn to that. Explains the role of big-time media and the disappointments in the quality of the coverage. Another matter that was alluded to by Eve Engler, I could ask where we stand here. I have something I want to make sure we read. This is from the Ottawa Citizen. It was alluded to earlier in our broadcast here by Eve Engler. And because I asked him about the NDP and why they're not debating over the potential involvement in a war with Syria or Iran, and their leaders have said and did indeed vote for the Libyan action. So here it is 1 year later. Ottawa Citizen writes the following. The radio on board HMCS Charlottetown crackled with the news. The Canadian warship's boarding party had struck pay dirt. A vessel in international waters, loaded with weapons and ammunition, trying to sneak into Libya. This is 1 year ago during the fight there. It was May 2011, 3 months into Libya's civil war, and NATO had set up a ring of 20 warships to enforce a United Nations arms embargo. No weapons, military supplies or ammunition were to reach Libya, either for the troops loyal to the country's leader, Muammar Gaddafi, or to rebels now fighting to overthrow him. Quotes, "There are loads of weapons and munitions, more than I thought." The boarding party radioed back to Charlottetown's commander, Craig Skirpchen. "From small ammunition to 105 howitzer rounds and lots of explosives, the Libyan rebels operating the ship openly acknowledged they were delivering the weapons to the forces in Misrata." Skirpchen, that's the only way I know how to pronounce it, radioed to NATO headquarters for instructions. The response was swift. Let the ship sail on so the crew could deliver their deadly cargo. A NATO senior officer, Italian Vice Admiral Rinaldo Verri, had boasted just weeks earlier that the alliance's blockade closed the door on the flow of arms into Libya. Not quite. While the UN embargo was clearly aimed at preventing the delivery of weapons both to Gaddafi and those fighting him, NATO looked the other way when it came to the rebels. Hundreds of tons of ammunition and arms breezed through the blockade, exposing what critics say was Canada and NATO's real motive during the Libyan war: regime change under the guise of protecting civilians. Qatar, we just heard about Qatar, one of the two Arab nations to take part in the NATO-led mission, supplied rebels French-made Milan anti-tank missiles with deliveries made by sea. The country also gave them a variety of trucks and communications gear, while Qatari advisors slipped into Libya to provide training. Egypt shipped assault rifles and ammunition with U.S. support. Poland supplied anti-tank missiles and military vehicles. Canada also didn't sit on the sidelines when it came to supplying hardware for the rebels. 5 months into the... Are you listening, NDB? 5 months into the war, Canadian government officials set in motion a plan to provide surveillance drones to rebels so they could better attack Libyan troops day or night. Are you listening, NDB? The Scout Micro Unmanned Aerial Vehicle, designed and built in Waterloo, was a small spy drone that fit inside a suitcase. The Canadian government put them in contact with the rebel National Transitional Council, while the Zareba Security Corporation, a private security firm in Ottawa, was to make the delivery. In July, the $100,000 drone was delivered to the rebels by Charles Barlow, president of Zareba and a former Canadian Forces officer. He took an 18-hour boat ride from Malta to the NTC training facility in Misrata, sailing without problems through NATO's blockade. Barlow showed the rebels how to fly the drone, using it to identify a Libyan military position, and then shortly after. About a month before his trip, French aircraft challenged by NATO air fighters enforcing a no-fly zone had dropped an estimated 40 tons of ammunition and weapons. It was citizen, folks. Weapons, including anti-missiles to rebels fighting southwest of Tripoli. Therefore, I think it's time to ask the NDP again. You say Brian Topps, that is his name, he says he's okay with what happened in Libya. So he's okay with that. We lied to the world. We were not helping the rebels. We were helping the rebels. We lied to the world. It was a no-fly zone. We used it to attack Libya. So they're getting ready for Syria. Somebody better answer some questions at the NDP and elsewhere. Go to the Monthly Review site and look at black Africans being tortured, by the way. Go ahead and look at it. It's there today. You can see the actual video of the maltreatment of Africans. So you've been listening to the Taylor Report, me and Phil Conlon. And Carol, thanks very much. Write to us here at caut.fm, and we'll see you next week.